Sure. Gary, do you want to do the request to record this?
I thought we at least first tell them who's on, and then we'll start the formality.
Milana Vickers, I'm a writer with the commission.
This is Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm also part of the writing team.
And I'm Stephen Mintz, part of the writing team.
Okay, we have three writers looking for quotes. And I'm Gary Cohen. I'm the general counsel of the commission. And AB, you have you and Mr. Friedman?
Exactly.
Okay, well, why don't let me, if I may, I'd like to turn on the tape recorder now and start the whole formal process of going forward. Is that okay now?
You're on.
It is. Gary, just if we can make a request, if there's going to be quotes utilized, since this is would be from an audio, we would respectfully request the opportunity just to review them to make sure that's exactly what he said.
Absolutely. Indeed, Milana, when we've got the tape uploaded to the system, why don't you send Mr. Culverhouse an actual digital file so he can have the whole interview?
Sure, we'll do that.
And we'll also do that as well, maybe.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, very good. So we can start the tape now, I guess.
Okay.
Okay, this is Friday morning. It's 11 o'clock on the East Coast, October 15th. This is Gary Cohen speaking. We are at the interview of Stephen Friedman, who is accompanied by his counsel, A.B. Culverhouse, from O'Melveny & Myers. Joining me in Washington, D.C. are Alexis Simmendinger, Milana Vickers, and Steve Mintz of the FCIC staff. Mr. Friedman, this recording, this interview is being recorded. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed by the staff. We are collecting the thoughts of the leading figures and some who are not so leading in the financial community and the rest of the United States about the financial crisis, its causes for it, the run-up to the crisis, and the events that occurred in 2007 and 2008, which finally brought the crisis to full blow to a head. We'll ask you a bunch of questions. We've got the guidelines that we discussed before, and we'll do this. This is very, very informal, as you can tell by the way it's already started. So if at any time you have questions about what we're asking or want to elaborate on answers, just feel free to go right ahead.
Yeah. Mr. Cohen, if I may, you provided us with a thoughtful list of topics you wanted to talk about. I have some points of view as to causes and run-up which come at it from a somewhat different direction. And I think if it went through them, it might put the rest of my remarks and thoughts in context. May I take a few moments just to...
Yeah, absolutely, since the first question I was going to ask you was generally what are your thoughts on the crisis and the run-up to it, and if you'd like to expound, it sounds like you're well-prepared, so why don't you go right ahead.
All right, and first of all, as just as a caveat or preamble, I am not an economist. I'm not a scholar, so my comments are very personal and just from the standpoint of one who's observed the markets for years, but come with no greater pretense than that. When I started in investment banking, left the law and started in investment banking in the mid-1960s, my recollection is someone gave me a book that had been written in 1841. I forget the title. It's a
Extraordinary Delusions.
I think it was by
Charles Mackay.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. And subsequently, I've looked at other books. Professor Kindleberger, late Professor Kindleberger of MIT, Robert Menschel, written books about manias and panics. And one lesson is that bubbles and market crises have occurred as long as we've had markets. and they've occurred innumerable times, and they've concerned a great variety of assets. And it's, in my view, very useful to see that there is in general, a common pattern. I am told that the first stock was in early 18th century Great Britain for the South Seas Company, and that then led to the first bubble. And over the years, we've had excessive waves of euphoria and bubble pricing for a wide range of assets, commodities, real estate, and very often amplified by excessive leverage. And the conclusion is hard to escape, but certainly I accept it that, as one wise old lawyer said to me years ago, man is not a rational animal, but a rationalizing animal. And he meant that in a very gender-neutral way. Rationalization, episodes of irrational exuberance just seem innate. First, something creates a surge of optimism, usually something good. It leads to over-optimism, and herd behavior then takes over, and the optimism about the asset class leads to increases in prices. More investors then follow the herd. It's frequently fueled by increased leverage, because after all, it's clear that prices are only going to go one way up. You have a speculative fever. You will draw your conclusions. My own conclusion is that housing prices follow that pattern, and lost their moorings to traditional standards of value, traditional ratios as to value versus construction costs, as to prices relative to homeowners' incomes, etc. Then, at some point, something occurs, and lending standards and optimism can't be stretched any further, and nervous lenders reduce leverage and prices stop going up. At that point, investors start to fear, and if you're highly leveraged, everyone understands the math of it. The leverage on the downside amplifies the price declines. Therefore, others start to sell, and a race to the door ensues. I remember reading something years ago where from memory, the key line was to the effect that the tulip bulb auction was scheduled to take place, but the bidders really didn't show up and bid.
Can I jump in and ask you to analyze recent events in the context of two of the things you just noted? You talked about leverage causing prices to go up. Now, you would have been at the NEC at the time that the SEC agreed to let Wall Street raise leverage limits on many of these derivative products, notably CDOs. Do you remember that decision by the SEC, and how would you have advised President Bush at the time?
I have no recollection of that.
Does that mean that the NEC wasn't talking about these issues at the time?
I have no recollection. We were certainly talking about the markets in general. I have no recollection of the issue you were talking about, so I don't want to comment on it.
What were you saying about the markets in general?
What I was saying about markets in general is that if there's a great deal of optimism...
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Friedman, forgive me. In that period of time, You said there was a great deal of there was conversation at the NEC about the markets. I want to know what that conversation was.
Forgive me if I interrupted you and you were on your way to saying that.
You know, I don't have notes back on that period, and I really am having trouble dredging from my memory things that were discussed about this in 03-04. With respect to housing prices, I was specifically not involved in the discussions about Fannie Mae because I had been on the Fannie Mae board, and so I was recused from that, and I stayed out of that topic.
What other areas would you have been recused from when you were on the NEC?
Basically, housing prices and Fannie Mae related stuff.
Does that go up to CDOs and all derivatives?
The function of the NEC at that time really didn't relate to, in my recollection, really didn't relate to that granular a review of those instruments. We didn't have anything at that time that appeared to be a crisis that would affect the whole economy, so we were not involved in being a supra-regulatory body over the SEC.
But you were there because of, in President Bush's words, your savvy about the financial world. Maybe you could explain, just to help us direct our questions better, what you would have formally asked to have been recused from in that role, because I could see how, given your past as chairman of Goldman Sachs and a really storied career, I mean, you could have recused yourself from the whole darn economy, practically.
No, I was recused from Fannie Mae and related stuff, which included the mortgage markets.
Well, okay, the CDO market starts to rise. I mean, Fannie Mae is dominating that the mortgage-backed securities market up until 05, but say by 03, while you're still there at the NEC, Wall Street is a big player in that field. So are you also recusing yourself? I mean, will we be able to show, or can you show that you said, look, I can't look at mortgage-backed securities even? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
You know, what I'm trying to tell you, ma'am, is that 2003 is a long time ago. I have not gone back and tried to jog my memory because I did not think that was within the ambit of the questions I was told to consider, and I just have no recollection of those topics. So you can continue drilling on this, or we can move on.
I'm just trying to understand what it is that you are saying you were recused from. And maybe you could just tell us what sorts of market issues you did advise the president on at the time.
You know, I don't think I'm going to get into what I advised the president. I don't think it's appropriate to get into the advice that a president's advisor gave him, and I really don't think that the events back then had a high degree of pertinence to the topics you're asking about now.
Les, why don't you finish your thoughts on this, and then we can sort of ask specific questions, because there are some areas where your just general background is going to be very helpful, since you came from a side of the investment banking industry which is no longer running the investment banking industry, and things of that nature, which are also of concern. It's sort of general background information as for your role in the investment banking community, and then how it segued into your government service. So why don't you pick up where if you can remember where you left off when we were talking about?
Yeah, I was saying that what happens is that leverage has amplified the price increases on the way up, and by the same token, leverage amplifies the price prices on the way down. It seems to me you can find the parallels in this crisis when you look at loan-to-value ratios in mortgages going up substantially. And what happens in most of these crises is that when people need to meet margin calls or for some reason they need to conserve cash, they often need to sell their better or more liquid assets. So prices of many assets that were not initially implicated in the crisis tumble, and correlations between different asset classes just get out of whack with historical norms. In other words, instruments that you might have thought were not in any way imperiled by a crisis get hurt because people just needed to raise cash. And I think you could see it here. In a way, it's as if someone shouted fire in a crowded theater, and the fire doors, they discovered the fire doors were closed. In other words, liquidity dries up when it's needed the most. And so the U.S. recovered from the dot-com bubble around the turn of the millennium, and within give or take a half dozen years, a major credit bubble was heating up. And this is part of a worldwide phenomenon, and you could see housing bubbles in, from what I've read, in Great Britain, Spain, Ireland. And in the U.S., it extended not just to the financing of residences, but much more broadly, commercial real estate, acquisition financing. And if you looked at it, even from the outside, you could see eroded underwriting standards and eroded terms, very consistent with historical patterns. And lending, very much including subprime, increasingly imprudent, standards deteriorated rapidly. Competition among lenders very often is a problem in these situations because people worry about giving up market share, and that can lead to a deterioration of standards. And so, for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into more when we get to your specific questions, we had a very vulnerable financial system that was waiting for a spark that would ignite the conflagration. And subprime mortgages, from what I've read, aggregated roughly a little over $1 trillion in value. And my understanding is that, you know, relatively speaking, that was not that big a part of the worldwide capital stock. I think Chairman Bernanke said in a published speech that in the worldwide equity markets, you can have a negative delta of greater than that amount on a really bad day. But in this particular crisis, the subprime credits were often buried within various institutions' balance sheets and within complex securities, which gave very limited transparency. And a metaphor that one of the New York Federal Reserve officials, Joe Tracy, used in a published speech is that it was analogous to hearing that there's a small amount of E. coli bacteria in the meat supply, and consumers are going to distrust anything which could somehow be tainted, and so there's a flight to safety till all the meat is recalled and inspected. Well, you had a flight to safety when people didn't know what existed in different institutions or different complicated securities, and the system is up. And so investors came to distrust a broader range of suspect securities, who was really exposed, and they then pulled back from many types of short-term financing where they could pull back, from repos, from commercial paper, from interbank lending, and that led to a panic which affected the funding system of the country, and that in my layman's view, was the real nub of the financial panic.
Mr. Friedman, hi, this is Stephen Mintz again. I share your interest in history. But I think the one thing that distinguishes this crisis between all other from all other crises since the 18th century is that you were in a position of authority to do something. So I wonder, how did you apply these lessons? How did you bring these lessons to bear in your tenure?
When you were at the NEC, it was the beginning, I guess, of the bubble. Really, it got completely out of hand, I would think, fairly in 06 and 07, but I guess you were there until 05. Was there a concern?
I was there till the end of 2004.
Okay. Was there a concern, and when you left the NEC, were you still a student of this? Because it sounds like you've been very thoughtful about it. Did you sense a concern in the country, or were you taken surprised by this, as so many other people appear to have been?
ISIS?
The run-up, the problems. It seems that Goldman, since you were still affiliated with Goldman, had a particularly good sense of what was going on. And were you aware of that? Do you think anybody else at the Fed, in your tenure at the Fed, was aware of it? Was it treated seriously enough, do you think?
It's just a correction. He was not affiliated with Goldman while he was the NEC.
Afterwards, when he went back. But during that period, I mean, Mr. Friedman had a particularly good vantage point, certainly.
Well, I will give you my personal view.
Yeah.
And from a number of your questions, you were assiduously questioning whether this was a major topic during the time I was at the NEC. And the earlier part of the time when I was at the NEC, my recollection, and we're going back a number of years, my recollection was that the biggest concern was the country was still digging out of the recession we'd had in the early part of the millennium, and a concern about an overheated economy was not, or an overheated markets was not a concern. And did you worry about market crises? Yes, we worried about them with respect to oil prices. You always worried about them a great deal with respect to currency. I remember a great deal of focus on currency, but housing prices were not, as I say, was something that I was recused from and was not focusing on for that reason. After I left the government, and I would say it was not promptly after 2004, it was really several years later, yes, I began to be personally quite concerned about what I saw in the markets, because I could see in lending for financial transactions like acquisitions, or in what I could see in commercial finance, in commercial real estate, it seemed like leverage was going up, covenants were getting weaker, and we had it just seemed like there was a substantial degree of vulnerability. When I did start to focus more on residential mortgages, I could see that the same kind of deterioration in quality was taking hold. Loan-to-value ratios had gone up. You had these various teaser loans. There were just lots of reasons to believe that ultimately we would have something that ended unhappily. So I would say, speaking personally, I thought we had an unhealthy situation by the time we got into 2006, and certainly early in 2007. I do believe it is possible to recognize bubbles. I think there are some things you don't know about the bubbles, even if you think you've recognized one. I don't think you know how long it's going to last. I don't think you know what will ultimately prick it, and it's very hard to know what the best policies are to deal with it without hurting the general economy. But by 2006, I think it was reasonably clear that we had problems of some sort coming. As I said, I did not have, nor did anyone else realize how serious it would be. In early 2007, one of the major banks had a write-off on its, it related to subprime loans, and it was highly visible at that point that lending standards had dramatically eroded. But even before that, as I say, I think the statistics gave cause for serious foreboding.
Do you think any of the Wall Street had, what kind of culpability did they have, if any, in this erosion of standards?
Yeah, let me ask you a background question before you answer that. You were at Goldman before it became a publicly traded, right?
Correct.
And you're from the client side, not the trader side. I would say, you know, M&A and advisory work.
That was my original background. Ultimately, as the chairman of the firm, I would have had responsibility for both.
Did the culture change after, and not just Goldman, because, you know, Goldman's only one of them, but I mean, did you sense the culture changing on Wall Street in the investment banking community once the major firms became public companies? Did you notice any?
I will comment on Wall Street generally as an observer. I'm not going to get into specific Goldman matters. You've had the chance, and you have the chance to speak to their management. I think that is a commonly stated, and in my view, overstated. And to be honest, I think it's the wrong rule of thumb or approach to try to seize onto. I think that you asked two different questions, and one of your colleagues asked, was there culpability on Wall Street's part? Well, I don't think that you can, crises don't come from just one cause. I do believe that what I dimly remember from law school many years ago, the doctrine of proximate cause, applies in situations like this. In other words, the train wreck could have been headed off if the engineer had been more alert, but also if the track walker had noticed that the lines were out, and by the way, if the blinking light, the light was supposed to blink, was working. And I think there are multiple parties here who could have done better. I don't think well, there may be particular institutions or individuals who handle things prudently. It's hard for me to think of any segment of our society that could not have done better in this crisis, and very much including Wall Street. When you say Wall Street, let me take it away from that phrase and talk about the financial system writ large, because it would include unregulated mortgage brokers and many other institutions. And how can you look at the meltdowns of many of those portfolios without being very critical of the risk management standards that took place in many cases?
Risk management at what level? At the level of the Wall Street firms, or?
Well, I think you've had various of the. Well, you want to get into it more broadly as to causes. I would say, as I said, there is of our society that could not have done better. For instance, I don't know anyone who wants to make a ringing defense of the regulatory system that we had in the run-up to the crisis. I think it's been characterized by some of the regulators themselves as not being adequate for the 21st century in terms of being having overlaps and gaps. And so that system needed dramatic renovation. I have not heard anyone willing to ardently defend the rating agencies.
If you go through this litany, if you disagree with any of those positions, let us know. But because I'd be interested, particularly in your view, rather than what other people think.
I'm saying things that I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fact that we had not only over leveraged financial institutions, but over-leveraged households and an over-leveraged government weakens the resilience of the society to withstand impacts.
Could you finish your thought on the rating agencies?
Well, it's clear that many institutions were given AAA ratings that, in retrospect, should not have received them. And it's also clear that many people accepted the ratings and made their decisions based on them, who would have been better off being somewhat more skeptical. All of this is not in any way to exculpate the financial system writ large, because I think there were... as I think I said, I believe there were excessive leverage, insufficient, and this is these are gross generalizations, because I say every institution was not did not fall prey to these things, but writ large throughout the community, there was too much leverage, there was insufficient liquidity. There was too much reliance on short-term debt. In many cases, there were probably not good enough information systems to aggregate the exposures. In many cases, there was insufficient hedging to lay off risks. And by the way, all of these things cost money. And so in some cases, there was probably an unwillingness to spend the money, because what you have in these bubble environments is the state of optimism, and people take their eyes off the tail risk. So I am not, I think that the areas that need improvement in our system are extremely widespread. And hopefully many of these improvements have been taking place in the last 2 years, because the shock of the kind of period where we've gone through tends to concentrate people's minds wonderfully, at least for some period of time.
Yeah, it's a question of how long.
Can you go back to the other point you made, which is about regulatory failings, and elaborate on that?
Well, now, I was not involved in the regulatory side of things. As you've been told, the directors of the New York Fed are explicitly walled off from that. So my sense of that is based on after-the-event speeches and comments. I really have no particular observances other than if you read comments by Fed people themselves, Chairman Bernanke, President Dudley of the Fed,
if you read their published speeches, I think they acknowledge there's a lot of stuff that could have been and should have been done better and lessons they tried to learn. But I can't give an inquest in what they should have been doing then. I do have views as to what should be done going forward.
Well, can I stick with hindsight for a brief moment? We've had other people at sort of your level of in advisor roles to administration saying that it was a real missed opportunity for the Fed to not have taken prompt corrective action, you know, in its supervisory role, say mid-decade, you know, against the very existence of CIV. So what do you think about that?
I really don't know what information they were getting. I don't know what they did. I'll make some general comments which don't relate to an inquest and what they did or didn't do. But I think that I think a system that allowed CIVs or that type of entity to be off balance sheet, I do believe in a system where financial institutions mark to market all their exposures, whether technically on the balance sheet or off the balance sheet, and I think that leads to very healthy realism.
Mr. Friedman, there's maybe a misimpression that you can correct, because is that in the run-up to the greatest financial crisis since the 1930s, the chairman of the New York Fed was kept out of the loop. That's what it sounds like. Can't be right. Or is it right?
Well, it is absolutely, if you mean with respect to regulatory matters, it absolutely is right. But the board of the New York Fed, board is somewhat of a misnomer because it makes people think of the way the board of a regular corporation or bank would be involved. And well, actually, virtually all that type of thing that might have a conflict in it, the board is walled off from. Majority of the members on the board were bankers who had some major financial affiliation, so by definition they would have had conflicts. And with the function of the board, and if you read the material that Mr. Culverhouse forwarded to Mr. Cohn, the board's function was essentially to act as an advisor to the staff regarding local economic conditions, trying to provide the type of cop on the beat understanding of what was happening in the markets. I think if it was a regional Fed board that was in an agricultural area, they'd be talking about farm prices. If it was an industrial area, they'd probably be talking about auto sales. In New York, a fair amount of it was non-financial, but a lot of it was financial. And then the board had some administrative duties.
But like what? What?
Explicitly excluded and walled off from the regulatory issues for the reason that most members of the board would have had a stake in that.
Now, would you have been a Class A director?
By statutory design.
Would you have been a Class A director of the New York Fed?
Mr. Cohen, you and I had a conversation about this, and this is an area that has been dealt with over and over again. The rules were clear. Mr. Friedman was a Class C director, he's testified under oath about what the board did and didn't do. That testimony is available. We can send it to you. This is not what we agreed to talk about.
Let me ask Mr. Friedman with respect to the board's role. If indeed there was a, or maybe if it didn't occur, perhaps speculation if it could have or even should have, then because it does sound like the board's role was deliberately limited. Mr. Friedman, you had on the board colleagues, Jamie Dimon was on the board, and other people in the industry. Should there have been a mechanism for, do you think, for some way for concerns of industry to, if indeed they weren't made known to the people who were at the, you know, at the New York Fed directly and the National Fed, for those concerns to be shared on a more formal basis?
When you say concerns, is this Mr. Cohen talking?
Yes, it is.
You say concerns, what types of concerns do you mean?
Oh, for example, I mean, Goldman's pretty well acknowledged to have sensed the problems in the market or perhaps earlier than other firms, certainly earlier than Bear and Lehman. And if indeed, if that sense of concern had been shared at the Fed, whether the Fed could have taken action more aggressively than they did, whether that would have been a better structure and a better use of the industry expertise that was available on the board. I don't know, really this is a theoretical question because it obviously wasn't the way it was set up to work. But I'm wondering if part of a regulatory regime, there should be some way for the regulators to have a better understanding of what's going on in the world, in the world that they're regulating.
Well, let me take a crack at that. We were walled off and completely insulated from any regulatory actions or any extraordinary actions or certainly anything we were doing with respect to particular institutions. But in my mind, and I'll just talk about what, in my view, a regional board should be doing, not get into anything specific about what this board did or didn't do. I think it's completely fair game for the board to acquaint the staff and the president of their regional bank, and through him, the board in New York, with areas that they thought should be of concern to them, such as overheating in particular markets, or a weakening of covenants, or that type of thing. That's not talking about institution X or institution Y. I think it'd be very fair to say, here's what we're seeing in the market at this point in time, and here's something that you ought to be paying attention to. I think that comes within the range of advisory and is very different than regulatory action or extraordinary action relative to a particular institution. Is that responsive to what you're saying?
Yeah, in part. I mean, do you think that that it could have been, you know, everybody has views in hindsight, and generally eyesight is pretty good looking backwards. But are there things that you wish had been done differently, just on a personal level, with respect to whatever positions you had at that time, that, you know, that whoever else in the financial community was saying, look, this is a real problem. Was there any way that you see now, looking back, to have perhaps paid more attention to that?
Well, speaking personally, I was on the, without any pretense of clairvoyance, I was fairly consistently on the pessimistic side of things throughout the period of, let's just say, 06 on, or even before. And I won't get into anything specific, I said, and frankly, I don't really remember specifics, but I do remember being vocal in a number of different settings with the fact that we appear to have a heating up of the environment, of the financial environment. So, no, personally, you never look back on things and say, well, I did everything I possibly could have. That would be hubris of a high degree. But I do not think I was one who was mostly looking at things through rosy-hued glasses during that period.
We had testimony from one of the members of the Fed Board of Governors at the time saying that presentations by Fed staff were made to them in 2005 talking about, you know, frothiness or however you care to describe it in the subprime market, and that this posed potentially catastrophic risks. And the testimony was that, you know, all of the members heard it, and many may have agreed, but they felt that at a supervisory level, if they went and knocked down the originating activity of banks under their supervision, they would sort of wreck the level playing field. And I wonder if you remember any conversations along those lines, and you know where you'd fit on that sort of continuum from intervene, you know, in 2005 or to don't intervene.
That's just exactly the kind of conversation that would have been walled off from,
and would not.
First of all, I don't think I was on board the Fed till
November 07?
I think it was it 07 that you became
chair? January 07.
Yeah, January 07, but even if I had been there, it's the kind of conversation that would have been walled off from. But I think there was probably plenty of statistical evidence during that period that the markets were getting quite frothy. That's essentially the nub of what I've been saying to you.
Well, did anybody to your knowledge, did anybody understand how the subprime market had? You used the word E. coli before, and other people have used it as well.
Yeah, not my metaphor, but I think it's a very good one.
I mean, we interviewed Dr. Krugman, and he said he didn't see that there was a. He was aware of the problem with the subprime, but he didn't see how it would infect the rest of the financial system. Did anybody have any understanding, as far as you know, either through your service at with the Fed or when you were at the NEC or just in general of your in your financial experience, have any understanding of how interrelated apparently things were?
My impression is that. Let me say this. I do not remember reading or hearing anyone point out just how this subprime had invaded other securities and other assets. I don't remember anyone referring to that. I do remember when the problem started to get focused. At least one conversation with a sophisticated person where, and there may have been published stuff from the Fed, where there was a sense that, as it turned out to be false confidence, that the problem was isolated, and after all, this is a relatively small part of the whole financial system, and if I'm correct that the number is maybe 1.2 trillion of subprime mortgages, how can that be a giant negative for the whole environment? And so I do think it's fair inquiry on your part. I can't give a blanket view as to whether that was one of the big missed signals that if you didn't know where the bad stuff was, the safest thing is to pull away from any place where it might be. And by the way, even if I'm very confident that your bank or your money market fund doesn't have the problem, I may not be confident that other people will realize that, and I don't want to be last on the queue if they start to pull out their money. So all of that leads to a race to pull out money, not do interbank funding, not do repo funding, or at least change the terms dramatically, sock money into short-term treasuries, And so I think that was probably a very big part of the transmission mechanism, or at least that's something that I think you're on a good trail there pursuing that.
Well, but in your experience, both in both of your public and quasi-public service, this wasn't something that people were actively thinking about, it sounds like.
Well, I don't remember anyone talking about this is, even when it became clear that there were problems in subprime, I don't remember anyone talking about this may have an enormously amplified negative effect because of the fear factor that I alluded to. In other words, where might it be? Look, you're dealing with the Achilles heel of the banking systems is that they are dependent on short-term financing. And as long as there have been banks, they've been subject to bank runs. And if you have shadow banks, there's still short-term financing that they can be subject to runs on. And when you have problems, people very often tend to say, I'd rather be safe than sorry, and they just pull their financing. So that's what you had. And when I heard people during the crisis talk about being unwilling to lend to great names, great institutions, they were basically saying, I just don't know what they have in their balance sheet. I don't know what they have in their instruments. And so if you in your inquiries are pursuing that thread, I think you might also want to look at the complexity of some of the underlying instruments.
Oh, believe me, they are complex, and we've had a lot of testimony on how complicated they are. Who, in a perfect world, who should be worrying about that? It sounds like you had mentioned earlier about the multiplicity of the various regulators and the perhaps inadequacies of our regulatory system. Who should be looking at those kind of larger picture issues? Do you think that should properly be a Fed role, or should it be some other agency or Treasury?
My own sense is that the Fed is the institution best able to do this. I think they would acknowledge that there were flaws in their record. I don't think they have shied away from acknowledging that, but I think they still have the best ability to do it. I think that there is a need to worry about a patchwork regulatory system with overlaps and gaps, which can cause some things to fall between the cracks, or jurisdictional types of issues. But I believe that one of the crucial things to look at is the. And here is one of the good things that happened in the recovery. I happen to think that the Fed and the Treasury and Congress actually did some very good things after the crisis had erupted that kept it from being much worse. So, I think kudos are deserved there. But one of the very good things that was done was the stress test. And the most beneficial thing about the stress test were, first of all, they used assumptions that were, if not the most stringent, were fairly tough. Secondly, there was a high degree of transparency. They told people what their approach was and what who had done, how the 19 institutions rated had done. And I think that gave people confidence that they had more information, and I think was an important part of stemming the meltdown. My own thought would be that such stress tests and the publishing of them, the results, ought to be a regular feature going forward, and hopefully would lead to less reliance on rating agencies and more of a race to the top. I also think, and this alludes to something that you have touched on the fringes of, I think regulators have to have going forward a cop on the beat kind of understanding of markets, so that the kind of issue you were probing about, well, where are these subprime mortgages, and are reasonable investors able to understand and analyze where not only where they are but where they're not, so that everything doesn't freeze up? I think they have to have sources of information, and I think that means constantly probing and talking to the companies they regulate, but also to industry groups where these things come out, because the credit abuses during this period were not subtle. Many of them were flagrant.
Can I stay on this point for 1 second? I mean, you're a person whose personal philosophy has been, you know, after you've had some success in private life, that you would give back by, you know, providing your advice and your understanding of that system to those people who are supposed to be the cops on the beat and who clearly, you know, have had a great difficulty in understanding the complexity of the system. I mean, does this kind of design work when a person like you ends up in quasi-public office and is apparently unable to advise on his areas of expertise?
Well, there's nothing that says that people on a regional Fed board can't talk in generalities about things in the market that they find troublesome, nor I think would they feel that they couldn't talk about that. But the types of things I'm talking about now are things where you would really want more granular information from the people who are heading the trading departments at various major firms, or from the bankers who are doing the lending at these various firms. And, you know, you're dealing with a level of specificity. I could not have told people what the makeup was inside SIVs, some of the various banks conducted. To get that information, they should have been talking to the people further down, and maybe they were. I just don't know.
Okay, but I mean, the market research produced by the likes of Lehman and, you know, other banks, you know, mid-decade. I have in front of me a research report from 2004. About home equity loans and opportunities for investors there, which has, you know, very clear government-issued data on home ownership rates rising, the spread of subprime mortgage rates to conventional prime, and plenty of extremely clear indicators on the very high risks and very high returns in this market. I mean, this is public information for anyone who cared to look it over. It's on Lehman's website at the time. Well, probably it was proprietary for a while and then became public. I mean, whose job is it to explain to the administration that Wall Street's learning about this and capitalizing on this and even shorting this?
Do you mean the administration, or do you mean the regulators?
You know, perhaps
both.
I mean, it's really both. I mean, you don't really want your.
I mean, I'm just saying this personally, editorially. I don't think you really want your federal government, your White House, getting into regulatory matters regarding particular institutions. Your regulatory bodies are in their regulatory operations are really supposed to be independent. So it's really
I mean, I think if you have some great macro issue, it's fair for an administration to be necessary for an administration to be worried about. But I think in the first instance, you really have to be focusing on the regulators. And if you take the material that you just cited that you saw on the Lehman webpage, which obviously I haven't read, once you have read it, what does it lead you to conclude?
I mean, that is the problem, is that...
Because you may well read something there which focused on the risks, and if you went to the web page of some other firm, you may well have seen something which focused on the opportunities. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about bad assets, and there's a phrase that I've heard many, many years ago, that there are no bad assets, but there are bad prices. And an old automobile that you may think is junk is very valuable to a junk dealer. Defaulted Thai credit card receivables may look like junk, but to the person buying them very, very cheaply and hoping to make a good profit, they look like an opportunity. So,
right. Well, the background on the author of that Lehman report is he's the one that Paulson and Company hired away in 2005 to do what, you know, we all know he did subsequently.
Look, at the end of the day, someone tends to be right and others tend to be wrong. Sometimes the person who tends to be right tended to be right years before he was wrong. And there's a famous line from Lord Keynes that markets can stay can stay irrational much longer than you can stay liquid.
But going back to the early part of your answer, you said you don't want, and maybe I misunderstood you, but surely you don't mean that people in advisory roles to the government, or in supervisory roles, or in regulatory roles, especially at the highest level, you know, where they're being hired because they've had a career in the business, that they really should be sticking just to traditional macro. I mean, surely, you know, this is evidence that decisions at the level of individual firms have humongous macro consequences.
I mean, I don't think I said that, and I'm not sure what I could have said that gave you that impression.
Perhaps you could just elaborate on what you meant. I'm sorry I misunderstood you.
What I did say is that is different than be involved in regulatory or supervisory matters relative to a particular information, a particular institution, which you should be sealed off from unless you're a regulator. That doesn't mean that one couldn't voice a view that the market for XYZ asset is getting overheated, and covenants are getting much too light, and too many turns of leverage are being extended, and et cetera. Now, what the regulators would do with that afterwards, you are walled off from, and you're not pointing them to particular institutions.
Okay, but so was the Bush administration ill-served by its economic advisors? Should they have been at least noticing and telling him? And Paulson, in his memoir, says that he never had a single conversation about President Bush about this topic before.
I was not there after 2004.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you what was said and what was not said, so you're going to have to go to other sources for that.
Well, what about in the time you were there?
You know, I'm not going to get into confidential stuff I talked to the president about. I will say that I think it is within the purview of advisors to talk about things that are worrisome in the markets. And I don't think it's, since some things were said publicly about this, We spent a lot of time focusing on oil and a lot of time focusing on currencies.
Let me ask you something. You've heard, of course, are familiar with William McChesney's Martin's quote about taking the punch bowl away when the party gets good. In your career at in the financial industry, did you obviously regulations were relaxed? You know, some can say more than others, and different viewpoints as far as how much they were relaxed. But Glass-Steagall finally went away, and there was more freedom for innovation in the financial services industry. Were you consciously aware of that, or was it just something that happened as you were, you know, in your career at Goldman, for example? Do you think that there was a conscious effort on the part of the industry to encourage, you know, Greenspan's viewpoint that markets will take care of themselves and the less involvement of regulation or government, the better? And so there was a kind of a shift from the McChesney Martin's, perhaps paternalistic, but certainly more involved regulatory philosophy to the Greenspan hands-off philosophy. Do you have a view on that, whether that was a good thing, whether that turned out, as even Greenspan has admitted to?
Yeah, no, I have not read his whole testimony before you. I've seen comments on this where he said this was a surprise to me or made a mistake. He is a very brilliant, a very sophisticated man. I'm not sure that I frankly find it hard to believe that he had as simplistic a view as implied, Mr. Combo, what you just said. You know, if you look back at, you don't have to go back to ancient history. If you look back at within the memory of everyone on this phone conversation, the banking system had a, from memory, had a big crisis in the early 80s from Latin American lending. You had the savings and loan crisis, the Resolution Trust Company around 1990. You had the long-term capital crisis and the Asian debt crisis in the late 1990s. You had the dot-com bubble. So how or why would anyone believe that markets are self-calibrating, self-regulating machines, except over long periods of time, which are really too long to help the system avoid crises? So I think that is, I certainly don't believe that markets are that self-regulating over anything but the longest periods of time. And B, other than some extremely theoretical perception of some finance professor somewhere, I just don't know anyone who conducts themselves based on that assumption. Everyone in this telephone call recollects the great excesses of the dot-com bubble. So how could anyone seriously believe that markets are self-calibrating over relatively modest time periods? No, markets, to the extent the taxpayers are involved, need regulation. But the phrase regulation is used as if this is a binary concept. Do we have regulation or not regulation? Well, you have to get into what we can actually do with this regulation. And I find it fascinating that none of the things we have discussed talk about what you actually expect regulators to do.
We thought you didn't want to talk specifically about regulation.
I'm not going to talk specifically about anything that I was involved in at the Fed. I do think it's fair to talk about, in the world we're going into, what is it that we hope regulators will do in order to minimize the chances of another horrible episode such as we had in 07.
Well, one of the questions that we have is the proper role of regulation in the system, and you know, that's a good segue to something that you sound like you do want to talk about.
Yeah, in general, regulation is I do believe we need robust, thoughtful regulation. I think that the concept that if something is quote regulated and therefore is safe is obviously not valid, because you can look at many of the failures of the recent crisis, and they were regulated. They had regulators. As a matter of fact, Fannie and Freddie had their own regulator. Certainly, the banks that had serious problems, like WaMu or NatCity or Wachovia, were regulated. So, you know, it becomes not just are you going to be regulated, it's how do you make it effective regulation?
Do you think that the regulations that we had and the regulatory structure that we had were, you know, do you think the structure was a problem? Do you think the regulations was a problem? Or do you think that the implementation was a problem? Or you can choose any one of the three, or any combination. It's like a Chinese restaurant.
I really think that you're talking about regulatory structure first and implementation third. And what was your?
Well, you've got the structure, you've got the actual regulations themselves. You know, you got all the alphabets of various agencies and departments that are looking at various parts of various financial institutions, and then you've got. So you've got the alphabet structure, and then you've got actual regulations themselves, and then you've got how those regulations, as they were enforced.
Well, if you look at regulatory structure, it takes a specialist in these areas to know exactly what the different roles were of the different alphabetized regulators. And exactly who is in charge of what. And then if you look at AIG, you'll find an example of an institution which was big enough to jeopardize the whole system that apparently did not have robust regulation of its most exposed arm. The one that stole the credit derivative swaps. So I think right there, Mr. Cohen, you have an instance of something where the regulatory structure did not suit the nation's needs, because you have to I have to assume or hope that a robust examination of their swap position might have made some very constructive recommendations or instructions as to better hedging them. So I think when prior to the legislation, Dodd-Frank, there was a sense that, okay, we really need to streamline this system. It's not clear to me that what has come out has streamlined it. I do think it's constructive that we have, whether it's precisely the right mechanism or not, that we have a mechanism that is at least designed to look at systemic risk and systemically important companies. So I think that's important. I don't, as far as the implementation itself, I think if you talk to the regulators themselves, based on what I read in their published speeches, they would acknowledge that they could have done a more vigorous job. I think going forward, one thing that I believe would be very constructive for them to do is to have very regular meetings at the senior regulatory levels, or at the senior Fed levels, with the boards of systemically important companies, in order to tell these boards, who typically are generalists, they're well-meaning, capable people who typically are come not from, from non-financial backgrounds, but to tell these boards, here are the things we're seeing in the markets that concern us. Here's what we want you to be concerned about. Here's what we want you to be urging your managements to be doing. When you run your internal stress tests, here are some of the tough assumptions we want you to be using, because there tends to be a risk that the assumptions do not take into account sufficiently the tail risks, and this is what we want you to be doing. And by the way, what is it that worries you, directors, that we should be thinking about?
Mr. Friedman, if that's the case, do you think it's a good system of governance to have the chairman of the New York Fed so completely walled off? You would think that kind of governance would come from that position. I'm missing the point, say so. That's fine.
I think you are. I believe what I am talking about is the regulators meeting with the boards of the banks. I do think that the boards of the regional banks should be walled off from anything relating to regulation of particular institutions or anything extraordinary. I don't think they should be excluded from discussions about what is happening in the markets writ large if it doesn't relate to supervision or regulation of institutions or extraordinary actions. But what I'm talking about has got nothing to do with who is on the board of the regional Fed banks. It's interaction between senior regulators and the boards of systemically important companies, because we have to expect the boards to exercise important oversight over management, and they should have channels of communication from the regulators telling them what it is that the regulators are concerned about.
Okay, but so evaluate the existing design. I mean, in a way, you're sort of drawing, at least in part, what is the existing model. I mean, the various regulators have staff at the headquarters of the large corporations they regulate, every day of the week, every day of the trading week. And, of course, the design of the Fed, as you well know, is that the banks can, they have skin in the game. They contribute, forgive me if I get this wrong, 6% into the Fed system. They comprise the various regional Fed boards, and then it goes up the chain. They elect the members of the principal Fed, and so everyone can have that kind of a conversation you're describing about what's going on in the market. So did that design work, or?
I'm going a step further, and I'm saying that it would be for the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of whatever area to meet with the boards of any systemically important institutions in his region, to elevate it to that level and to have a very frank discussion of what is happening in the market that he would like the boards to be specifically focusing on.
So how would that work in your region?
Well, the president of the New York Fed would meet with the boards of the systemically important banks on a, you name it, once a year, or if there was something more troublesome more frequently, and have that kind of very candid discussion.
Okay, well, I mean, are you disagreeing that that's roughly what they had in mind, and why didn't it work?
Well, I'm not aware that went on. If it did go on, then they're doing it, and I applaud it, but I'm not aware that it went on. I think there might have been episodes, but I don't think it was a regular thing. I don't think publishing stress test results, I think, happened once, and I think it was 2009. I don't think it's, I think also, among other things, I think that the boards need to be encouraged. One thing that has not come up in this discussion, I think, is crucial. I think risk management, frankly, is less about structure than it is about culture. the culture of particular firms, and it's got to be a culture that's oriented towards making sure that risk management is perceived as being every bit as important, if not more important, than producing revenues. And I think that has to be really borne home to the boards of these major institutions, that there's got to be a culture that rewards bad news flowing up. The risk management people have to be compensated and promoted every bit as attractively as the producers. If there's a disagreement about risk, the risk manager should win. His no is no. That senior managers are expected to be walking around and immersing themselves in what's going on in the trading areas. That doesn't mean day-to-day, but not a remote bureaucratic hierarchy.
It means
compensation having a large or even overwhelmingly subjective element, with risk management being crucial. Means expecting the boards to make sure that a lot of money is being spent on information systems which aggregate risk within the firm. And this is the type of thing that, to me, are more important than anything else in reducing the risk of future catastrophes such as we experienced.
Now, in order for I mean, it would be great if firms did all those things, and you know, in a sense, they do have a lot more information than ultimately they share. But in order for supervisory or regulatory elements to compel that sort of good governance, they have to understand what the heck it is they're supervising and regulating. I mean, did you see in your time examples where you just the sheer complexity of derivatives and this sector of the economy, you know, cowed regulators? Or, I mean, you think that's a problem?
I have not seen what you're talking about. As I said, I have not been involved in the regulatory side from the regulatee side. I know you have smart, hardworking people, as one of you said, virtually living within the firm. I think they are as smart as the people they're regulating. I don't think they're cowed by it. But if an instrument is too complicated for ready analysis, that in itself tells you something about the risk propensity it has, and that in itself is a warning signal.
Well, stick with that for a while. Should there have been going back to whether it's leverage limits or stick to leverage limits. Should there have been higher leverage limits on activity in you know, these sort of innovative securities?
Well, I mean, that's what the Basel Accords are all about, is what should be the leverage limits on financial institutions. And that's what capital standards are all about. So if you have a system that's been negotiated for years, one might argue it's taken too long to do it, but it should relate to what you're talking about. It should basically mean that if an instrument is more risky, at a huge degree of complexity and asymmetric risks within the instruments and are indicia of risk, then yeah, there should be more leverage. It also means that you have to have much tougher standards on liquidity, which I think Basel III will have.
Is that a change of viewpoint for you, or have you always thought that?
Absolutely not. I've always believed that if you worry about the defense, if you take care of the defense, the offense will do just fine, and your profit making will be just fine. I've always had a personal propensity to worry about tail risk. That's just me. That's a willingness to leave money on the table in order to sleep better at night. I can't argue that my risk-reward balance is the precisely right one, but no, it's not a change for me.
Do you think, you know, clearly there were massively different levels of risk management effectiveness in Wall Street, and you related it culture, and I had asked you this question earlier about the change from a general partnership to a corporate form. You had said you didn't think that really had an impact. I mean, were firms who had less effective risk management in 2005 and 6 and 7, you know, the same firms who had less effective risk management in 1985 or 1990 or, you know, before they became corporations that were publicly traded? And is this something that is possible to inculcate through regulation, or is this you're just going to have to rely on, you know, whatever the spirit is in the air in the various firms? I mean, how do you get to that role?
Yeah, I think you're getting to some very important points, which frankly I think are much more crucial in terms of making the system safer than some of the questions about what someone said to someone else, you know, 8 years ago. I think that I can't really answer the extent to which there's been a carryover of the cultural propensities in firms over long periods. I do think you're onto something crucial in that to build a culture, to change a culture and improve it and build it. It takes a period of years. You know, give you a rule of thumb, which is scientifically unprovable, 5 or so years. I think regulators can play an important part in this if they identify the elements of what you want to see in the culture. And this gets back to what I talked about, educating the boards on what they want to see so that the boards in their meeting interaction with the managers and their oversight of the compensation. If you want to change the culture of an organization, what you need to do is to first figure out what do I want that culture to be. People use the word culture without having thought through what they want. And if you want to have a culture of assiduous risk management, you have to sort out the elements of it. And I gave what I thought were a lot of the elements of it. Then what you have to do is make sure that your compensation and promotion practices reward those elements. Exhortation and preaching to people about it and giving awards to people who do it is useful up to a point. But at the end of the day, if people do not see that the individuals who are promoted and rewarded have been conducting themselves in a way that management says is important to them, that they will not believe it's truly important to their careers. And I absolutely do believe that regulators can add and insist on and demand that kind of cultural change. And I think at the end of the day, that is important.
Can you talk about the...
I go beyond important. I'd say crucial.
Can you talk about the incentives inherent in punishment as well as reward?
Absolutely. If one incentive is that if you made a mistake in your trading and you promptly owned up, it is tolerance. I mean, if you keep on doing it, your competence is going to be in question and your career is going to be over or suffer. On the other hand, if you give any hint of a cover-up, you're gone. I think that is a very crucial thing. I think that on the positive side of the ledger, you want people from the newest recruit on the trading desk to feel that his job isn't just producing revenues. His job is keeping the firm's risk levels in appropriate in an appropriate band. I mean, remember, these are firms that exist to take on risk from clients and to intermediate it and so on. So we're not talking about them being risk-free. We're talking about keeping it in balance. So if the recruit feels that way and his trading desk head feels that way and the head of the division feels that way, that's a positive incentive if they're rewarded for that. And it negatively, it should factor into their, I believe, in 360-degree reviews of employees. And if you tell someone that here are the good things about you, and we applaud them, but here are the areas that are areas for improvement, and that's why you are not going to become a partner, or that's why your compensation is not what you hoped it would be. Yes, that is exactly what you talked about. Those are negative incentives. Incentives work with rational people up to a point. We never want to exclude the chances for irrationality, euphoria, panic. But by and large, in most periods, you can influence the conduct of individuals and an organization. And it's not only monetary, it's who is perceived as being culturally positive figures in an organization. People work for a lot for pride, not just for profit.
And can you also add, in the executive suites of many of the firms we're thinking up about in the run-up to the crisis, do you think that the negative incentives attached to risk had just been forgotten or put aside for a while?
Well, I cannot speak from first-hand knowledge about any of them, because I know the people to say hello to. Mm-hmm. I was not there. I was not talking to them. I think, to my mind, it is much too mechanistic to think that it was purely financial incentives that drove some of the imprudent behavior. I think over and over with negative phenomena, you see a rationalization process. And when we started out this thing, I talked about the humans are rationalizing animals, and I think it is very possible for people who've given a lot of their lives to the success of a particular organization, who feel intertwined with that organization, to be rationalized what their position, how good their positions are or aren't, and frankly, to lose objectivity.
You've said publicly that we're bound to find ourselves in another crisis at some point. It's just the history that we've seen in the financial system. So how can that element of the culture be changed going forward, would you suggest?
Well, I think that's the litany of things that I went through. I think that, in the insurance industry, they focus a lot on the risk appetite of particular ventures. And their rating agencies have standards. You have to be able to withstand whatever it is, a 1-in-100-year storm and a 1-in-250-year earthquake, and still be up and paying your bills and surviving. And I think that you have to get boards focused on healthy survivability is not something that can be remotely put in jeopardy. And that comes down to value systems. The Dutch had a horrible floods in the early 1950s where they lost many people. So they decided to build a levee system that would withstand a 1-in-10,000-year storm. We built a levee system that you saw in Katrina, Rita, Wilma. Boards have to make a decision that, we can't withstand a thermonuclear weapon because we're in a risk business, but we have to have cut out the tail risks. And then I think they have to conduct themselves in terms of the amount of leverage that they have, the amount of liquidity cushion they have, the culture that they make sure they have so that they are not jeopardized going forward. Those, to me, are, you know, you, one of the questions you asked was about lessons of the crisis, and I think looking for lessons learned is a very valuable exercise. But the saddest lesson is how poorly we have internalized the lessons over multiple prior crises.
My own endeavor is
just as one person who's with all the inherent fallibilities is telling you what I think the curative lessons are.
As a student of history, did you feel any particular frustration or maybe even some responsibility as in a position of authority as the crisis unfolded? And I don't mean that as an adversarial question. I mean, there you were at the Fed watching yet again another crisis. How'd you feel?
Well, you know, you say you didn't mean it as an adversarial statement, but what I think I tried to say innumerable times is our job there was not to regulate or supervise the industry, and it couldn't be such for the reasons I stated.
Yeah, I understand that, and forgive me.
I also said that I have not. I have never been hesitant to voice what I thought were risks, and without, as I said, any pretense of having a crystal ball, you can assume that I did that. So no, I feel no sense of. I feel a great sense of regret for what happened, but...
I'm sorry, could you repeat what you just...
This, I certainly was not, do not feel having been guilty of over-optimism or failure to recognize risks.
I don't know if I understood you there. You're saying we can assume that you did warn, or we can assume that you did not warn?
I think you can assume that that... In conversations with a wide range of people, when matters of the economy came up, since I had a view that lending standards had deteriorated in commercial real estate, in acquisition lending, in residential real estate, I was not shy about expressing those views. But I'm not going to get into particulars.
Well, I mean, this is sort of a controlled environment for you, and insofar as this is the draft of the history of this period, I mean, I'd certainly invite you to share some of that with us.
Well, I have shared with you that I felt that during this period, lending conditions had deteriorated, and it had a bubble-like feel when you saw the prices people were paying for commercial real estate, when you saw the prices people were paying for acquisitions, when you had names like Liar's Loans and the different humorous names people had for the covenants or lack of them and acquisition lending.
Okay, well, I can certainly, you know, respect your desire to keep names out of it, but maybe if you could just paint the picture for us a little more. You know, what would have been reactions to the warnings you were giving, and what sort of historic, what year is this, and what forum are you addressing?
You know, I don't think I can ever remember people saying, you have a deeply erroneous and excessively pessimistic view about these things. On the other hand, you know, markets are created by people with different points of view. And so it's always a huge mistake to feel that you have found original truth.
We have, I think, exceeded the time that we asked from you. If anytime you'd like to stop, there's so many other topics that we could talk to you about.
Mr. Friedman's got a hard stop in about
I mean, I think he's got to be someplace else at 1 hour time. So we've got about 3 more minutes, Mr. Kuhn.
Well, Mr. Freeman, is there anything that you'd like to? I'll just throw it back to you, since you've been very forthcoming on a lot of issues and very helpful on some. Is there anything that we haven't asked you that we should have? Let me put it back to you.
Well, let me just look at what I jotted down here. I think there's going to be. We're going to learn a lot in the next couple of years as regulations are drafted to implement Dodd-Frank. And amongst the other very important things, we're going to learn how the regulations and how the, in practice, how the resolution mechanism works, which...
Well, one would hope the resolution mechanism doesn't have to get tested, but we'll see.
No, I think best to prepare on the assumption that it has to be. And one suggestion I have, and it may be an obvious one, but I think this is immensely complicated in drafting these living wills, et cetera, and I think it would be a very wise thing for the regulators to do war games and simulations on winding down some of these enterprises in order to just see what comes up in terms of the little stumbles that we might not be wise enough to see in advance. I have found simulations to be very useful. I would say another thing is that it is impossible to draw a playbook which will cover any future crises. Based on history, you have to, based on history and also just based on caution, you have to assume that future crises are likely. I think that the regulators are going to need a certain amount of flexibility in that time period. There's been a great deal of beating up on the regulators in Congress over TARP and some of the other things that they had to do. My personal belief is that those things kept our financial system and our economy from even worse travails than they had. And I think it would be extraordinary. It would be a great understatement if they were denied the ability to improvise and be flexible in future crises. I also think that it's a very important distinction to make between people who ran their business imprudently and, on the other hand, people who were running their business well. No one goes without undefeated or without defects, who got swept up in the crisis. When you have a credit crisis and a run on the bank, run on the financial system, to me, it's analogous to a great forest fire out in the West. I may have been running my factory in accordance with all the fire regulations, and you might be a mile from me, might have been breaking the rules and had lots of greasy chemicals around that ignited. When the Rangers come and put it out and they save my plants, I'm very grateful, but I don't bear the same responsibility as the person who led to the triggering of it, and I think it would be unfair to sweep the good in with the bad. I would say that as part of the moral hazard argument, I think we have to have a system where unsecured creditors feel the pain when institutions are run badly, so that they monitor who gets credit, and that has to be done better. And I think we really want to be sure that the boards of these institutions have, these financial institutions have directors who, majorities of directors who understand finance. Generalists can be very valuable, but this tends to be specialized stuff. And I would just close on saying that that, as I said earlier, talking about the importance of regulation is fine, but it's got to be effective. And for it to be effective, the regulators have to be the mirror image of the best risk managers at the best practices private firms. They have to be conceptually as good. They have to be as informed. And you do have a lot of smart people doing it. I think it would be very important to make sure that they have the financial support to develop the human resources for the challenges that they have. And above all, I'd say my experience has been that you can talk about these cultural issues, these structural issues, but above all, culture is destiny, and that's what needs to be worked on, both at the financial institutions and at the regulatory bodies.
Okay, well.
Can I ask one quick question? Mr. Freeman, you mentioned the macroeconomy or the economy. The FCIC has to also look at the linkage between the financial crisis and the economic impact afterwards. Can you quickly, I know you're not an economist, but can you summarize how you assess where we are economically now and what concerns you the most, perhaps, looking ahead?
Yeah. What concerns me the most looking ahead is, and I'm looking over what is the what is likely to happen in the economy over the next two or four quarters, which every brokerage firm and bank puts out reports on, and some are more optimistic and some are less. I don't know anyone, though, who is not acutely concerned about our national financing, state and local financing, and if they're paying attention, pension fund financing in the state and locals. And I think one of your questions related to future sources of crises.
Right.
And as history shows, it can be a lot of different assets related to the future crisis. You know, they've been over electricity, over ebullience about railroads, it's been the autos, it's been commodities, it's been silver, it's been copper, it's been oil. So who knows what that'll be. We do know that when leverage gets mixed up in the banking system, they get to be much worse. And so that's crucial. But if you want to look at your candidates to be worried about, here I do not think you need a crystal ball. You ought to be worried about national financing and how to deal with it. And I'm being totally nonpartisan and non-prescriptive. State and local financing, you see the troubles many of our states have, and state and local pension funds.
Can you talk about what kind of trouble we could be in there as, you know, nationally at the state and local levels, the natural spill out rate on that?
Well, I think you're best off getting more detail on that from some competent economist. But you know, when I talk to people who are focused on the investing for not-for-profit organizations, endowments, you hear a lot about the short-term concerns that have been publicly expressed about risks of deflation. But the longer-term risk is a worry about inflation, about interest rates getting very high, about a strike from foreign owners of the U.S. securities, about if about future discomfort concerning the stability of the dollar. And so by, say, future credit crises can occur, future panics can occur, and I think we're going to need to have a regulatory structure which has independence and the authority to take actions that are needed at that time, because the purpose of central banks has been over the centuries to be the provider of support and credit of last resort.
Do you happen to know whether the smart bankers out there are trying to communicate up the chain into Washington to talk about what you just described with the risks at the local level, the pensions? I mean, is there enough discussion currently, do you think, or are you aware of?
I could not tell you the level of the discussion. I can tell you, though, that if you read your daily newspaper, you're going to see discussions of that on a regular basis. Is the capital of such and such state going to declare bankruptcy? How underfunded are the pension plans for such and such state or locality? What's the debt level going to be in the federal government in X number of years? These are not. Let me say it this way. With a lot of assets, you will find clear evidence, a very smart analyst saying this is quite overpriced. This is quite overpriced. It's clear this is riding for a big fall. And if you look further, you're going to find equally smart analysts saying, yeah, this may not be the best quality, but where it's priced now, we see enormous opportunities. I mean, that's what makes markets. I think with respect to the issues that I've just been talking about, I don't know anyone who's got a particularly benign point of view. And I don't know anyone who doesn't think that the longer we kick these problems down the road, the worse they'll be. So when you're asking about what are future sources of crises, these have to be in your candidate list.
Well, it sounds like your Concord Coalition hat is still firmly on.
Well, I have not been involved in that for some years, but they tried for quite a number of years to sensitize people to these issues, and it would be hard to say the level of success has been what one might have hoped for.
Stephen, thank you very much. Amy, we can send you a copy of the audio file if we can figure out a way to get it to you, given the size that it's likely to be, but we'll make it available to you.
Okay, and if there's a problem with the size, just have someone get in touch, and we'll have our IT people talk to yours.
Very good. We can turn the tape off now, and thank you once again.